Good to see everyone. I guess I thought there was another verse in that song until that last slide came up and said end of song. We've already been up here. It's good to see everybody out tonight. And if you're visiting with us, we're certainly grateful for your presence and hope that you'll be back anytime you have an opportunity to be with us here at O'Neill. And we would love to have you as part of this church family. So anytime that you can come back or permanently come back, we would love to have you with us here. It's hard to believe, but we've been participating in this preaching program for 9 years. Doesn't seem like that. Well, it may seem like that long to you, but it doesn't seem like that long to me that we've been doing this. And the first lesson I ever gave was called Working as Members. And Brooke told me, you know, you need to do another sermon like that. So tonight we're going to do Working as Members, and we'll call this 2.0, version 2.0. And the first time I ever spoke, we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And tonight we're going to talk about Nehemiah. And I'm sure a lot of our older Bible students are very familiar with the story of Nehemiah, but if you're a younger Bible student, maybe you're not as familiar with this story. So let me give you a little bit of the context as we get started. God has decided He's going to punish the children of Israel for their unfaithfulness. So the Babylonians come in, they take the children of Israel captive. If we get to the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 36, the last chapter in that book, and it says, starting there, verse 17, God gave them all into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. They set fire, now in verse 19, they set fire to God's temple and broke down the wall of Jerusalem. They burned all the palaces and destroyed everything of value there. So as we go through Chronicles, we kind of are going through the Chronicles of the history of the children of Israel. When we get to the end of Chronicles, they go away into captivity. And so the Babylonians take them away into captivity. Well, if you're familiar with history, you know that the Persian Empire conquers the Babylonian Empire. And so the Persians come in and take over. And the children of Israel are in captivity about 70 years. And then Ezra and Nehemiah, you know, the next two books, these two men come along probably about 100 years after this. So, you know, they go away into captivity for 70 years. And then slowly in waves, they start being released from captivity and they start making their way back to Jerusalem. And that's when Nehemiah comes on the scene. And so we'll pick up here in chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 12th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men. And I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. So the people are starting to go back home. And he's wanting to know about the homeland. Now in verse 3, they said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broke down, and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. And what I'd like to do tonight is take some things in this book of Nehemiah and make some comparisons to here at our house. So the first thing we see is that God's workers care when they see that work needs doing. You know, here's Nehemiah, here's his reaction to the news of the condition of Jerusalem. You know, these captives have been released, they're going back home. And so he's anxious to know, what's home like? What's the condition of home? And when he hears about it, he weeps, he mourns, he fasted, he prayed. Most importantly, I think we recognize, he cared. He cared. He was upset because he cares so much. And so the first thing I think we can take away from this for us is that we should care when we see work that needs to be done. Each of us. Now, our condition is not like Jerusalem. You know, the walls have completely been crumbled in Jerusalem. The gates have been set on fire. You know, usually when a city has been vacated, you know, the wild animals move in. And so they're dealing with all that. We're not dealing with that. We're not dealing with anything that extreme. Our walls are not falling down. Our doors are not on fire. We don't have wild animals in the building, except for whoever let that dog in a couple of weeks ago. Our condition is not the same as theirs, but still, there's work that needs to be done. There's work that needs to be done. And love motivates us to do that work. 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 3. We remember before our God and Father, your work produced by faith, your labor prompted by love, and your endurance inspired by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. We understand we still have these same things. We have the same faith that they have. We have the same love that they have. We have the same hope that they have. And so these things motivate us. And when we see something that needs to be done, when we have faith and love and hope, we do it. We care and we do it. Let's go back to our story now. We understand that God's workers pray for help in doing God's work. He starts this prayer in verse 5, but we're going to skip down to start in verse 8. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. O Lord, please hear my prayer. Listen to the prayers of those of us who delight in honoring you. Please grant me success today by making the king favorable to me. Put into his heart to be kind to me. So we see Nehemiah's prayer as he's praying to God. If we had gone back to verse 5, we see that he acknowledges God's greatness, and then he confesses his own sin. And as we picked up in verse 8, he relies on God's promises. And then in verse 11, he asks for God's help. You know, you want to see what a simple, straightforward prayer looks like? This is it. God is great. I am a sinner. God has made promises. I need his help. You know, I think that's a prayer that all of us can pray. And we're in a bit of a transitional state here now. You know, I was preaching away a couple of weeks ago when the announcement was made that, you know, we're kind of starting to look for another preacher. And some, when things are in a transitional state, some kind of get nervous about those things, what the future's going to hold, maybe become a little unsettled. That can't be us, though. You know, we ought to be excited about growing, you know, about having someone else potentially come in and work with us. You know, that's a rallying cry for all of us, that we can get behind a person. You know, I don't know who that person might be. They may say things different than, you know, Brother Guy said them, or Brother Matt said them, or Britt or Stuart, or, you know, hopefully different than me. But that's a good thing, that we can have somebody else come in and work with us. And it's a chance for us to rally behind another person. So even though our state may be we're in a state of transition, our faith is steadfast. We certainly don't change our faith. Our faith should be unwavering. The Hebrew writer says in chapter 10, verse 23, let us hold unswervingly, as the New International Version says it, to the hope we profess. For he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good works. What do? We hold fast. We're always looking to God. Our faith isn't swerving. It's unswerving. It's steadfast. We're solid. We're always looking to God, and not only are we looking to God, but we're looking to help each other. We're always considerate of one another. What we have going on in each other's lives, how we can help each other. That's something that we should always be considering. Let's go back to our story now. God's workers take initiative. It's the next thing we're going to see. And seize an opportunity. Moving on to chapter 2 now, verses 4 through 6. The king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven and answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take and when will you be back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. You know, what is it that God's people do? God's people take initiative and seize an opportunity. And Nehemiah takes advantage of this opportunity, which is him before the king, and the king says, what is it you want? And he says, I want to go help. This is an opportunity for me to do something. And he realizes this opportunity is the answer to his prayer at the end of chapter 1. This is the very thing that he's asked about. This is the answer to his prayer. What about us? Well, I think we can take the initiative when we see an opportunity and seize the opportunity. And if our hearts are focused on the work, we're not going to miss too many opportunities. You know, Galatians 6, verse 10, Ephesians 5, verse 15 and 16 say kind of the same thing. Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity. As we see the opportunity, when we have an opportunity to do something, we need to do it. We need to take the initiative and do it, be motivated to do it. And we're not waiting to be asked. If you see a need, just fill it. Don't make somebody come ask you to do it, and don't make somebody come beg you to do it. Just do it. Just take the opportunity to do it. Because sometimes those opportunities, just like in our story, are answered prayers. You know, the thing that we've been praying about, the thing that we've been wanting and asking God for, and then an opportunity creates itself, we need to take it. We need to understand this may be the answer to that prayer. I need to seize this opportunity and take advantage of it. Going back to our story, I think the next thing we're going to see is that God's workers make a plan, and then they recruit other workers to help them, and then they get to work. Chapter 2, now verses 16 through 18. So Nehemiah has gone out and he's examined, you know, all the ruins, I guess you would say, of Jerusalem. And now picking up in verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing because I had yet said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in? Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace." I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. And they replied now, verse 18, "Let's start rebuilding. Let's get to work." So they began the good work. You know, they saw an opportunity to do something. They made a plan. They recruited other people. And they got to work. Nehemiah made a plan and he worked his plan. Verses 6 through 20, he enlisted like-minded workers. He considered the work, what needed to be done, made a plan, shared that plan with everybody else who was going to be involved, so they communicated, and then they got to work on it. Seems pretty simple. Again, I think there's things we can do here, making some application. We need to have a plan for accomplishing what needs to be done. You know, Luke 14 is a passage we recently covered in the 20s age class. It says, "Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, 'This person began to build and wasn't able to finish.'" You got to have a plan for what you're wanting to do. You know, that was one thing we talked about in the 20s age class around the beginning of the year. What do we want to accomplish this year in this class? You know, and after some discussion, it was decided, let's try to read through the New Testament this year and do a study on the entire New Testament. That's what we do on Wednesday nights. We're going through the entire New Testament in the course of a year. And so to do that, to accomplish that, and make it all the way through in a year, it requires that each student reads 5 chapters a week. Or, as I've told them, listen to 5 chapters a week. Put your earbuds in or your Beats on or whatever you listen to your audio Bible on and listen. Maybe on your Bluetooth in your car while you're riding. Listen to the Bible, read the Bible, but 5 chapters a week. And so we kind of set down, all right, we need to read these 5 chapters this week and these 5 chapters this week, and if we're going to get all the way through Revelation by the end of December, you know, this is kind of the plan for doing that. And if we're going to accomplish anything as a group, we got to have a plan and we got to work together to accomplish whatever that plan is. So we got to consider what we're trying to accomplish, and then we got to get to work. So it doesn't really matter what kind of plan we have if everybody's not willing to work together. But if we have a plan and we're willing to work together, then we can accomplish some great things. And we got to recognize that everybody has to do their share. 1 Corinthians 12, "All you together are Christ's bodies, and each one of you is a part of it." Ephesians 4, verse 16, the end of the verse says, "And each part does its work." So we have to understand that each part does its work, meaning each of us has a work to do. You know, there's something for everyone to do. Let's go back to our story now in Nehemiah. And in chapter 3, we're going to find that there's some people who think that maybe they're exempt from the work. In verse 5, "The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to work under their supervisors." So as it's going through chapter 3, it talks about, you know, each group of people who's working and what they're working on. And when it gets to verse 5, it says, you know, there's these certain people who just wouldn't shoulder any of the work. So it goes to other people. Does that mean it doesn't get done? No. You skip down to verse 27 and it's talking about, you know, the repairs made in the wall. And then here's the men of Tekoa again, repaired another section from the great projecting tower to the wall of Ophel. So some people didn't work, but these other guys, they carried the load. They were the ones that did it. Now, some people think that they're exempt from the work in our story here, and the rest just have to work a little bit harder. But I want to point this out from these passages in verse 8, that you don't have to be a professional to help. From our story, we see that. You don't have to be a professional to help. You got all these guys rebuilding walls here. Here's this guy Uzziel, I guess is how you say his name. It says in verse 8, he's one of the goldsmiths who repaired the next section. And Hananiah, he's one of the perfume makers, and he made repairs next to that. You know, these guys aren't professional builders. You know, one of them's a metal worker. The other guy makes perfume for a living. And yet when it's time to get to work on the wall, they get to work on it. You know, I don't know how they knew what to do, but I guess somebody showed them. I guess somebody trained and developed them for this work. But they were willing to work. Even though maybe it wasn't a skill that they had to begin with, they were willing to learn and they were willing to work together. So, for us here, you know, in our story, I think that, you know, we've got these nobles who maybe think they're too good to work. I don't think we have anybody here who thinks they're too good to work or thinks they're too important to work or anything like that. But kind of like what Stuart touched on a couple of weeks ago, sometimes you have people who don't realize exactly what they're capable of. And maybe they're capable of a lot more than what they're currently doing. Maybe they just need a little bit more encouragement. You know, Titus chapter 2, if you go through the first 8 verses there, it talks about the older people in the congregation teaching the younger people. Now, the psalmist says it this way in chapter 71, verse 18, even when I am old and great, do not forsake me, my God, till I declare your power to the next generation, your mighty acts to all those who are to come. You know, even when I get older, allow me the opportunity to teach the younger generation. I guess it's been, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I think that was on a Sunday morning, all the women kind of after services got together and they passed out like worksheets or whatever, and this whole section over here was full. You know, girls from age 10 to women in their 80s. And it was awesome. You know, watching all these women talk about the work that needed to be done. I think sometimes women are a little more organized than us guys are. You know, you have all these women filling out sheets of all the work that they'll do. Sometimes us guys, maybe we need to sit down and have a discussion like that. You know, Brother Casey, who did a great job in the meeting, on Monday night during his sermon, he asked this question. He said, you know, something I've been wondering, why is it there ain't no old men teaching young kids Bible classes? It's always women teaching young kids Bible classes. Why is that? That was the question he asked. You know, not just O'Neill. There's a lot of places you go and there aren't enough male teachers. And it's a problem. You know, here we've got more guys under the age of 45 teaching than over the age of 45 teaching. You know, I don't know if that's the answer to his question everywhere, but if we took all the guys who are over the age of 45 who taught and put them in the kids' classes, we wouldn't have enough guys over the age of 45 to teach the adult classes. Why is that? Well, maybe people are capable of more than they realize. Maybe we need to encourage them. If you look at Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 12, I'll say Paul because I think it's Paul, but the Hebrew writer says, for by this time some of you ought to be teachers. By this time, well, what time is that? Well, if you think about the history here, the church is established somewhere around the middle 30s. And Hebrews is written around the middle 60s. So no one he's writing to has been sitting in a worship service for more than 30 years or so because the church hasn't been in existence for more than 30 years or so. And he's saying, you know, after 30 years or so, I kind of would have thought some of you guys would be able to teach. That's what he's actually telling them. Does that mean everybody's supposed to develop into a teacher? Am I fussing at everybody who's not a teacher? No. That's not what I'm saying at all. But some people are probably capable of more than what they're doing. And I think that's what he's saying here. Some people are maybe capable of a little more than they're doing. You know, here or somewhere else, any congregation you go to, there are people who show up week after week after week waiting to be served. But we need everybody serving. We need everybody doing something. We're not just doers or hearers of the word only, but also we're supposed to be doers of the word. We don't need lifetime students. No congregation needs lifetime students. We have to graduate people from being listeners of the word to the point of being servants of the word. And maybe some of those even to being teachers of the word. So the church needs to, we need to develop women, but we also need to develop men into various roles. You know, ushers, greeters, teachers, deacons, elders, just a few of the roles. You know, we had a discussion in class this morning. If you look throughout the denominational world, you see a lot of women filling these roles. And some would say, you know, for a woman to do that, she's trying to be assertive or something like that. You know, I wonder if it's the case that women are filling those roles because men aren't. You know, maybe the church and church universal, not just church here, but maybe the church needs to develop more leaders, more men who are willing to be leaders. You know, in some cases you have women who want to be leaders. I apologize for everybody who saw that little girl run up here right before services. You know, we have trouble taking her to the kids' class because she wants to get up and lead a song, and she wants to get up and lead a prayer. And, you know, sometime tonight she's going to tell me, "You did a good job preaching. I'm going to grow up and preach one day." You haven't got to a point of understanding the roles of men and women relative to worship yet at my house. There are women who want to do that. And when men won't do that, somebody will. So it's important that we continue to develop people. What if current trends continue? If we don't develop, you know, young people for these roles, what are we going to have in a few years? What is the problem? You know, if I'm going to point a finger, I guess I ought to point a finger at myself, shouldn't I? I'll do some self-examination, and I hope you'll do the same. What is the problem? Back in Hebrews, when he said, you know, some of you ought to be teachers by now, he goes on then and continues in chapter 6. He says, "Therefore, let us move beyond the elementary teachings about Christ and be taken forward to maturity." The first thing he says, if you're going to mature, maybe your teaching ought to be a little better. You know, maybe that's a challenge to me teaching a class, or a challenge to me standing in the pulpit, to move to the deeper things, the deeper truths of the gospel. I mean, it's important that we talk about acts of worship and steps of salvation and things like that. But I mean, the kids know that stuff. So we've got to move beyond that into deeper teaching. So that's got to be a challenge for me. And for you, what is it for you to help you develop? Well, you're going to have to answer that question yourself. You know, each of us, we need to be able to find a ministry work. We need to be able to find some way to serve, something to do, something to give back. Could you do something? But as we see in our story, if you won't do it, somebody else will pick it up. Somebody else will. Somebody else will pick up that burden and carry it. We don't want that. We want everybody working together. The next thing we're going to see back in Nehemiah is that God's workers ignore outside ridicule. Going on to chapter 4, and we're going to start with verses 1 through 3. "So it happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?' Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, 'Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall.'" There's people who are going to criticize. There are people who are going to make fun. But as you go on in the story, verse 6, he says, "So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart." There's criticism, but they don't care. They just keep working. And we've got to ignore outside criticism as well. Don't listen to outside voices. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21, "Test all things, hold fast what is good." Test all things, hold fast what is good. Don't listen to the outside voices, even the familiar ones. You know, there's a lot of critics of the church, and some of the ones who are the loudest, who are the meanest, who say the worst things, are the ones who used to go to church. And on a personal level, some of the people who will say maybe some of the worst things you'll ever hear about O'Neill might be people who used to go to O'Neill. Can we ignore those voices? I want to go back and say, can we use those as motivation? Verse 4, we stopped in verse 3. Verse 4, Nehemiah says, "Then I prayed, hear us, our God, for we are being mocked. May their scoffing fall back on their own heads, and may they themselves become captives in a foreign land." You know, I want to see us be successful here. This work. I want to grow to a point where I better understand the mind of God, that I can try to live like His Son lived, that I have a better understanding of His Word that His Spirit revealed to us. And I want you to do the same. And I want us to be here a long time and be pleasing to God, and my children to grow up here, and your children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews to grow up here, and us be pleasing to God, and us be able to fellowship each other and encourage each other and build each other up. And all of those things motivate me. But let me tell you one other little truth. I want us to have success here just on a small level, to put it back on the people who said that we wouldn't. Do you feel that way too? Nehemiah felt that way. You know, anybody who would criticize the Lord's church, or O'Neill, if you want to make it personal, and say, the church isn't going anywhere, the church isn't growing, the church isn't developing people, the church is stuck in neutral, then I feel exactly the same way. I would really like those words to fall right back on their head. Because we can work together, because we can accomplish great things, because we can please God, because we can teach other people, because we can encourage each other. Is it personal to me? Yeah. Is it personal to you? Do you feel like we can accomplish those things together? If we go back to our story, we understand. God will help His workers finish the work. Moving into chapter 6 now, we'll start in verse 15. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. And it happened, when all our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. That's what happens when people see accomplishment, and they know that you're working for God. God gets the credit. Nehemiah and his fellow workers finished the wall in 52 days. You know, working construction, I want to tell you, when you work on a government project, they can't get the paperwork done in 52 days. So that Nehemiah and all of these men built in a wall around an entire city in 52 days is incredible. But what makes it even more special is that by doing this, they brought glory to God. That was the result of it. For those who've been following along with the Bible puzzle, God is working in you. God is working in us. And we have the ability to work and to bring glory to God. You know, Philippians 4:13 is a verse you often see on the bumper sticker. Philippians 2:13 says it this way, "For God is working in you, giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases Him." As we close tonight, are we pleasing Him? It's a simple question. You know, collectively, are we pleasing Him? But personally, are we pleasing Him? Are you pleasing to God? If you're not a child of God, then why not become one tonight? There's something else in your life that we can help you with. Come forward. Let us assist you with that. If we can help you in any way, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.